Welcome back. I'm Paula Gordon. Lawrence Hill, the author of a number of books, including Someone Knows My Name, is here with me. We are in Charlotte, North Carolina. We drove from Atlanta to be here. You flew in from Canada. Being Canadian American, I have to work at this. African American, African Canadian. But your parents are American, so you're sort of North American with African heritage, as of course we all have, going back to the Olduvai Gorge. When I have traveled, and remember, I've lived in the South a long time, every time I would go north, which is, I'm from Illinois, I'm not a Yankee, I'm from the land of Lincoln, I never make that trip but what I think about following the drinking gourd. I always think about the experience of having to escape to freedom, and I always rejoice, as my husband can attest, when I get to the Ohio River. It's very exciting. That sense of America, the drinking gourd, the Underground Railroad, escape was always to Canada. And again, you have widened the horizon with Someone Knows My Name to think about Canada ain't perfect either. Well, rats. I wanted Canada to be paradise, and so did your character. The whole complex of this is one that, again, speaks to the human condition. It isn't just America's problem, just the Brits. How does the flavor change being Canadian, as you are, with parents who are American? Or used to be. I don't know. Are they now Canadian too?
Well, they became Canadians. Yeah. Well, my parents grew up in the United States. My father was a soldier in the American Army in the Second World War, and my grandfather was an officer in the American Army in the First World War. So African Americans on my father's side and white Americans on my mother's. And my mother was raised in this sort of ultra-Republican family in Oak Park, Illinois. I don't know how she moved on to become a civil rights activist by the age of 20.
Good values.
That astounds me. But she somehow moved on. Yeah. And when my father met her in D.C., she was working as a civil rights activist. And he was in between graduate programs at the University of Toronto. He'd taken a year off to go back to the States to teach at Morgan State College in Baltimore and to live with his parents for a year. Met my mother. They fell in love, turned around, and left D.C. the day after they married and came to Canada. So I feel, in a way, I've always had a foot in both countries. Raised as a Canadian, but with an American family. And so back and forth in both countries a great deal.
You know, this notion of nation states may have lost its potency. Now, being brought together with you by the great sovereign state of Canada makes it a little bit chary that I should say this, but sometimes I wonder if we wouldn't do better just to forget those borders and say, you know, we've got some things in common and let's figure out how to get along. I really do wonder if the experience, and of course there's no way of knowing this, but speculate with me, what does the Canadian part add to the richness of this cocktail?
Well, if we're speaking specifically about the migration of African peoples in and out of the Americas, of course, Black history in Canada stretches back about as far as it does in the United States. The first documented enslaved African Canadian is in Quebec City in 1628.
1609, something like that.
Right, so it's within a couple decades. Yeah. And the first documented Africans in Canada are in Eastern Canada around 1603, 1604. So the history goes back just over 400 years now in Canada.
Did they come in free or slave?
They came in both ways. But eventually slavery takes root, and particularly in Eastern Canada and what is now Ontario and Quebec. We don't ever have the plantation economies or the weather to allow for the plantation economies that you have in the United States. And so slavery is primarily an urban phenomenon in Canada. It never becomes the major anchor of the economy the way that it does in the United States. It's not because
that's all of the United States, not just the South. Slavery affected the economy of the entire American
experience. I'm well aware of slavery in New York State and other places as well.
But you know, most people in America aren't. They think it's down there, that it was the South. They don't know about Rhode Island being the place where the slave trade was absolutely central to the trade itself, to the economy. The Connecticut was full of slaveholders. The only state, to my understanding, the only state that did not ever sanctioned slavery was Vermont. And Vermont, in becoming a state, outlawed slavery. But every other state, it was both legal and practiced. But I had never heard this about Canada having that kind of a slave heritage.
It did.
Why would slaves run to Canada if they have slaves?
Well, it's a very complicated situation. But basically in 1792 or 1793, the government of Upper Canada, which is now the province of Ontario, mm-hmm. abolishes partially the slave trade, meaning that they forbid people to bring slaves into the country. They free slaves after the age of 25 and so forth. So it's a partial abolition of slavery in what is now Ontario, then called Upper Canada. As a result, word travels south that if you can get to what is now Ontario, you will be free. So even though slavery continues and people continue to hold slaves in Canada, if you arrive in Canada as a person fleeing slavery from the United States, or what later becomes the United States, you are free. And so we find slaves and freed blacks coexisting side by side in various parts of Canada from the 1700s on.
Kevin Baker's whole trilogy that is City of Fire talks about New York, and he's keenly aware of the central role of race in the United States. And in each of his stories, I guess it is a trilogy, looks at the institution of slavery through the prism of New York City, and says that Manhattan is the bloodiest piece of land, of ground, within all of the United States, and it's always being fought over, and talks not at the length that you do, but he goes through what had happened in New York, and it's one of those eye-opening experiences of, oh, this would be New York City. And of course, with even well before the Fugitive Slave Act that comes along in 1850, as I remember, which just monumentally tears up the country, and it is Franklin Pierce, who's the great-great-great-grandfather of George W. Bush, thank you very much, under whom the Fugitive Slave Act comes into force. The things that were happening in New York, again, are a mirror image to every, but it's the same and it's different.
Yes, and the story of New York and Black history in New York is so utterly fascinating. I spent a lot of time in New York, and of course, went to the New York Historical Society and saw their exhibit on slavery in New York. And of course, I have a bunch of cousins, African-American cousins, who are living in Brooklyn. And oddly enough, they're all voting for Hillary Clinton, which I found fascinating. But anyway,
they
have been a real touchstone family-wise for me. And this history of blacks in Manhattan is particularly interesting in the context of the American Revolution, because for some reason you can't grow up in this country without knowing that the first person to die in the American Revolutionary War is a black man by the name of Crispus Attucks, serving the side of the rebels, the patriots. But and you can't grow up knowing, if you go to school in this country, that thousands of African Americans chose to serve the rebels in various ways during this war. And this has become sort of mythologized and an aspect of American legend, really, but somehow it's been almost entirely forgotten, conveniently shoved under the rug, that thousands of African Americans also chose to serve the British on the losing side of the American Revolutionary War.
Why would that be?
And the British promised them freedom in exchange for service. The basic deal is, and they issue these public proclamations that are written, which I've read, saying basically, if you profit from the chaos of revolution and flee the chains of slavery and run to behind British lines and service in the war in New York, we'll take care of you afterwards and provide you with liberty and security. So thousands of men and women with their children in tow do exactly that. And Manhattan, which is ruled by the British for all but 6 months of the American Revolutionary War, becomes a place of refuge for thousands of African Americans who are predominantly there to serve and to seek refuge behind British military lines. But when the British lose and they're pulling out, of course, what's to happen to the thousands of blacks who served them, who fought against and served against the very people that used to claim to own them? We can well imagine their fate if they're picked up by their former owners after the war. And
who were eager to do that, to reclaim what they said was their property.
They were not only eager to do it, but they were busy doing it. They were coming in and grabbing people and taking them as much as they could. So the British leave, and finally they agree to take with them the thousands of African Americans who can show that they served the British for at least 1 year behind British military lines. And if you can do so, if you can show that you served the British in some way for a year or more, then they'll take you out by ship after entering your name in this fascinating document, which I've seen in the New York Public Library at 42nd and 5th.
That must be just a heart stopper.
Yeah, which is called the Book of Negroes. And this document is 150 pages in length. It contains the names of 3,000 African Americans who are moving out of Manhattan, gives their name, their age, where they were serving in slavery, what the name of their former owner was, how they came to flee slavery, what they look like, any physical description of them. It's the first time that thousands of African Americans are publicly, formally documented by any formal body in the United States or in Canada. And these people are moving primarily into Canada. So it's like a community passport, this Book of Negroes, and it was such an interesting document, so riveting.
Where did you find that?
Well, as I say, it's in the New York Public Library.
But did you know about this before?
Well, I read
you
about it as I was reading scholarly works about the history of the black loyalists who served the British during the Revolution and then came to Canada and then turned around and left 10 years later. And so it's also in the National Archives of Canada and the National Archives of the United States and in the National Archives of the UK. And in, here and there, any enterprising grade 12 student could find it online. And
I'm neither enterprising nor grade 12. That's why I didn't know.
In this document, it was so riveting to me that I actually used it as the title of the Canadian edition of this novel. So in Canada, it's known as the Book of Negroes.
Oh, no
but
kidding.
In the United States, it's known as Someone Knows My Name. Same book, different title.
I can't go any farther without going back to Africa just so I don't get lost and forget to do it. My young friend who calls herself Aminata, so forgive me, her father was Mohamed Forna, who was executed by the Sierra Leonese government of Shaka Stevens for as the finance minister, and she was born to Mohamed Forna, who was a younger son of a lesser wife way back in the villages of Africa, and her mother was Scottish. And they had met when Mohammed had gone to London to medical school. So she, like you, has a very clearly defined sense of being bicultural and having parents of radically different colors. The Muslim part of this only began to get clear to me with Aminata talking about her father, who was Muslim. Your ability to go back and braid through how very important that Muslim element was, that is genuinely new to me, to think harder about how long these, spasms of religiosity, when she calls out, "I'm a freeborn Muslim," and that's supposed to save her?
Yes, it is supposed to save her, because Muslims were not supposed to be enslaving fellow Muslims.
That's a huge part of this story, and it's still very black, and it's still very much in Africa.
Yes.
And twice you make me look square in the face of this isn't a white problem, this is a human problem.
Absolutely, it's a human problem. All sorts of peoples, so-called Christians, so-called Jews, so-called Muslims, and all sorts of others were brought into the slave trade in different ways. And in Mali, the country in which my protagonist, Aminata, is born, wasn't called Mali at the time, but it's Mali now, and I've been there and worked there. There is a gradual Islamicization, a gradual Muslim spread through the country in the 1700s. And so the very part of Mali where she's living and born around 1755 or so, you find the Islamic faith sort of spreading its reach. And so we have villages that have people of traditional animist or other faiths, and we also have people who who are Muslims, and we have these people living together, and so there's a sort of an intermixture of religions and cultures and languages. And so Aminata does have a father who's a Muslim, and this is very significant because it plants in her the seed of literacy. I wanted her to desperately want to become literate before even she's stolen at the age of 11 and brought into the Americas. I want this seed to be in her from her family background in Africa, and it's well established by scholars of the slave trade that many African peoples who were brought into the Americas were literate. They were literate. They knew how to read and to write in Arabic. And so for my child, for my protagonist, to have this seed of literacy planted in her family culture, she has to be exposed to Islam. She has to be exposed to a father who's a Muslim. And so,
who's willing to teach the girl child?
Well, he's willing a little bit. She's not literate truly when she's abducted at the age of 11, but she's seen people, including her father, reading and writing. She wants to be able to read and write, and this desire she carries with her, and it fuels her intense acquisition of language skills and literacy skills in North America. And it's stunning and unbelievable as it seems, considering that it was against the law to teach a slave to read or write, or to learn to read or write if you were a slave. The fact of the matter is that many did go on to learn to read and write quite well. How do we know this? Because we have their books. Any good university library will reveal a large number of memoirs and books written by slaves, even in the 18th century.
The slave narratives are compelling for the beauty of their language and for the rawness of it, because they were not, this isn't the King's English, this is the slave's English, and often affected by the, do you call it patois, when it's like Gullah and English, it's,
sure,
or wherever. In fact, Henry Louis Gates has found a couple, as has David Blight at Yale has found a couple new ones. And these continue to surface. I must say that was that all the way through the book, as she's saying, you know, all these people are writing backward. Why are they writing backward?
Yes.
Oh, they're not writing Arabic. That would be it.
Well, just the language acquisition fascinates me. I don't think I've read a novel before that sort of charts or examines what happens to a person transplanted from African soil, arriving, say, in the 18th century in Charleston, South Carolina, who has to learn the linguistic adaptation.
She has to learn it. They're not going to learn hers.
Well, of course not. And she's not only got to learn English, she's got to learn white English, she's got to learn black English, she's got to learn Gullah. She's basically got to learn three languages.
And she's got to not use one with the others, because it could be her death and a lot of other people's.
Yeah, and just the challenges involved in learning language, arriving. And she's lucky enough to be a girl still. She's 12 or so when she arrives, so naturally she's going to pick up language faster than somebody who was twice her age or three times her age.
But it's the age, not the girlness, to which you're referring. It's not because she's a girl she can do it easier. It's because she's young that she can
do
it easier.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I didn't mean to suggest that she can do it because she's a girl. She can do it because she's young.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And certainly being young helps. And so, but still, even at 12, it's a big deal to pick up this language and to be wandering around and seeing all these black people walking by, and thinking, of course, that you can communicate with them, and finding that they have no language that is resembling yours, and you have none that resembles theirs, and how alienating and horrifying and frightening that must be.
And they're not trying to run.
No.
That's
and what's
they're
that
home.
All about? Yeah. Where are they going to run to? And so she has to sort of come to terms with this. And I found that fascinating, to try to imagine the emotional headspace, you know, of a young child, a woman child who's arriving like this, at just in puberty, you know, 12 or 13, arriving in Charleston.
Well, I was actually, we were in Charleston a number of years ago when, to my utter astonishment, and I don't even know why this happened, I looked up and there was a tall ship. That's what we call them, 17, in 1997. No, that's not right, 76. The tall ships, the masted ships.
Yeah.
I looked out into the Charleston Harbor, and this was in the 90s. And there was this ship that could easily have been headed for Sullivan Island. And it just, stopped me in my tracks, because suddenly I was 200 years back, and what I didn't have was the smell. Mm. And you are really, you're very harsh with me through this. I have to smell things. But to see that masted sailing ship in the Charleston Harbor, literally headed towards Sullivan Island, which Edward Ball was the first one to tell me, Slaves in the Family, 40% or more of the slaves who were brought into this country were brought through Sullivan Island, and at that point, at least, there was not one memorial, anything, to the abduction, to the introduction. There was nothing. Hopefully, they've begun to see their responsibility to honor that history. Maybe they're not there yet, I don't know. But the physical experience of seeing that ship come into the Charleston Harbor will never leave me. And to know, as you talk about, dozens of ships, all the time, coming in smelling of...
Smelling of human people rotting, human beings rotting and dying. And it was said, when you read the journals of people keeping slave ships or noticing them, that you could smell a slave ship 5 miles away. Mm. It was said back then. And I read this in diaries of people at the time.
So that Charleston, the city, would have smelled all the time of the corruption of its soul.
Well, when ships came in, yes. I mean, they weren't coming in daily. Yes, absolutely. And of course, bodies sometimes floated up on shores and so forth. And sometimes people tossed bodies overboard shortly before arriving. And so there were instances where corpses would, you know, come up to you know, on where the rivers met.
What she says at one point is, how much difference it would have made if she had had a father there. And in a way, she's always looking for somebody to be that father, that axis mundi, if you will.
She is. And I guess, I was thinking of her as my daughter as I wrote the story. And I was thinking, what if this had been my own child? And she was 11 when she's abducted. And my own child, my eldest girl, was 11 when I started working on this novel. And I think it's not a coincidence that she's 11. I was thinking, what if this were my child? How would she have survived? And if she'd survived physically, how would she have carried on emotionally, which of course comes back to the crux of the story.
Absolutely. So, how would this story have, now this is impossible all those years later, had you identified this character for yourself as a boy?
I never thought about it. I never even gave it a moment's thought. From the minute of conception, so to speak, this was a woman.
You knew when it was conceived.
Yes, it was a woman. I needed to write a woman's story. I wanted it to be a person who would catch babies for a living, but who would experience the agony of having to lose her own children. And it was utterly a woman's story that I wanted to write. And from the moment that I learned about these African peoples leaving Nova Scotia, going back to Africa, many of whom having been born in Africa.
You said something like a third of the people on those ships.
A third of the adults on these 15 ships leaving Halifax with 1,200 African Americans. A third of the adults on those ships had been born in Africa. Unbelievable.
Aminata Fourna starts one of her stories with the arrival in Sierra Leone, although you don't know that at the beginning of the story, and it just looks like the Garden of Eden. When these people come to Freetown, there is that sense, and yet, and Aminata's family includes Temne tribespeople. So again, the personalness of, oh, these are real tribespeople, and oh, the Brits are taking the Temne people's land so as to bring, the ironies of this are just absolutely, they just never let you go.
Yes, and one of the greatest ironies of all, which is just too great to be invented, it happens sadly to be true as well as to be part of this novel, is that when the black loyalists, as they're known, settle in Freetown, it turns out that one of the most bustling slave factories in all of Africa is located just 18 miles away, a scant 18 miles away. They all know each other. They're all interconnected. The abolitionists and the slavers are friends on the coast of West Africa here in Sierra Leone. They supply each other with food and they trade goods and, you know, they probably get drunk together and meet up socially. And so the most, one of the most
rape the same women.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And one of the most active slave factories in all of that part of West Africa is located just 18 miles away from this enclave of freedom where the abolitionists settled the black loyalists in Freetown.
If you look at the troubled history of Sierra Leone, knowing these roots really does make a difference, doesn't it?
It does, and it's a fascinating and complex history. There are so many peoples arriving there. We have the Nova Scotians arriving. We have the British arriving to govern the Nova Scotians in the Freetown. We have the Temne.
Not very free.
We have the Temne and the Mende and other African peoples in the area. And then we have all these other Africans who are being liberated by British naval vessels because they're violating the slave trade ban. And once being liberated, they're being dumped into Freetown. So we have Africans from all over Africa being taken off slave vessels and freed in Sierra Leone. So we have a sort of a culture that has peoples from all over the world, all over Africa and all over the world who are gathered there.
And then the history continues to unfold. We're going to be back in a moment with Lawrence Hill. Be with us when we return.